I opened my medical kit and drew out a stiff sheet of parchment. It was a trifle frayed at the edges, but would still serve. I sat down on the edge of the bed, smiling as reassuringly at Alexander as I could manage.
"It was kind of you to come," he said, struggling not to cough between words.
"You'll be better in a moment," I said. "Don't talk, and don't fight the cough. I'll need to hear it." His shirt was unfastened already. I spread it apart to expose a shockingly sunken chest. It was nearly fleshless. The ribs were clearly visible from abdomen to clavicle. He'd always been thin, but the last year's illness had left him emaciated. I rolled the parchment into a tube and placed one end against his chest, my ear against the other. It was a crude stethoscope, but amazingly effective. I listened at various spots, instructing him to breathe deeply. I didn't need to tell him to cough, poor boy. "Roll onto your stomach for a moment." I pulled up the shirt and listened, then tapped gently on his back, testing the resonance over both lungs. The bare flesh was clammy with sweat under my fingers. "All right. Onto your back again. Just lie still now and relax. This won't hurt at all." I kept up the soothing talk as I checked the whites of his eyes, the swollen lymph glands in his neck, the coated tongue, and inflamed tonsils. "You've a touch of catarrh," I said, patting his shoulder. "I'll brew you something that will ease the cough. Meanwhile," I pointed a toe distastefully at the lidded china receptacle under the bed, and glanced at the man who stood waiting by the door, back braced and rigid as though on parade. "Get rid of that," I ordered. Randall glared at me, but came forward and stooped to obey. "Not out the window," I said sharply, as he made a move toward it. "Take it downstairs." He about-faced and left without looking at me. Alexander drew a shallow breath as the door closed behind his brother. He smiled up at me, hazel eyes glowing in his pale face. The skin was nearly transparent, stretched tight over the bones of his face.
"You'd better hurry before Johnny comes back. What is it?"
His dark hair was disordered by the coughing. Trying to restrain the feelings it aroused in me, I smoothed it for him. I didn't want to tell him, but he clearly knew already.
"You've got catarrh. You also have tuberculosis. Consumption. And?"
"And congestive heart failure," I said, meeting his eyes straight on.
"Ah, I thought something of the kind. Flutters in my chest sometimes, like a very small bird."
He laid a hand lightly over his heart. I couldn't bear the look of his chest heaving under its impossible burden, and I gently closed his shirt and fastened the tie at the neck. One long white hand grasped mine.
"How long?" he said.
His tone was light, almost unconcerned, displaying no more than a mild curiosity.
"I don't know," I said. "That's the truth, I don't know." "But not long," he said, with certainty.
"No, not long. Months, perhaps, but almost surely less than a year."
"Can you stop the coughing?"
I reached for my kit. "Yes, I can help it, at least. And the heart palpitations. I can make you a digitalin extract that will help." I found the small packet of dried foxglove leaves. It would take a little time to brew them.
"Your brother," I said, not looking at him. "Do you want me?"
"No," he said, definitely. One corner of his mouth curved up, and he looked so like Frank that I wanted momentarily to weep for him.
"No," he said. "He'll know already, I think. We've always known things about each other."
"Have you, then?" I asked, looking directly at him. He didn't turn away from my eyes, but smiled faintly.
"Yes,"
he said softly.
"I know about him. It doesn't matter."
"Oh, doesn't it?" I thought. "Not to you, perhaps." Not trusting either my face or my voice, I turned away and busied myself in lighting the small alcohol lamp I carried.
"He is my brother,"
the soft voice said behind me. I took a deep breath and steadied my hands to measure out the leaves. "Yes," I said, "at least he's that." Since news had spread of Cope's amazing defeat at Prestonpans, offers of support, of men and money, poured in from the north. In some cases, these offers even materialized. Lord Ogilvy, the eldest son of the Earl of Airlie, brought 600 of his father's tenants, while Stuart of Appin appeared at the head of 400 men from the shires of Aberdeen and Banff. Lord Pitsligo was single-handedly responsible for most of the Highland cavalry, bringing in a large number of gentlemen and their servants from the northeastern counties, all well-mounted and well-armed, at least by comparison with some of the miscellaneous clansmen who came armed with claymores saved by their grandsires from the Rising of the 15, rusty axes and pitchforks lately removed from the more homely tasks of cleaning cow byres. They were a motley crew, but none the less dangerous for that, I reflected, making my way through a knot of men gathered round an itinerant knife grinder who was sharpening dirks, razors and scythes with perfect indifference. An English soldier facing them might be risking tetanus rather than instant death, but the results were likely to be the same. While Lord Lewis Gordon, the Duke of Gordon's younger brother, had come to do homage to Charles in Holyrood, holding out the glittering prospect of raising the whole of Clan Gordon, it was a long way from hand-kissing to the actual provisioning of men. And the Scottish Lowlands, while perfectly willing to cheer loudly at news of Charles's victory, were singularly unwilling to send men to support him. Nearly the whole of the Stuart army was composed of Highlanders, and likely to remain so. The Lowlands hadn't been a total washout, though. Lord George Murray had told me that the levies of food, goods and money on the southern boroughs had resulted in a very useful sum being contributed to the army's treasury, which might tide them over for a time. "We've gotten £5,500 from Glasgow alone, though it's but a pittance compared to the promised monies from France and Spain," his lordship had confided to Jamie. "But I'm not inclined to turn up my nose at it, particularly as His Highness has had nothing from France but soothing words, and no gold." Jamie, who knew just how unlikely the French gold was to materialise, had merely nodded.
"Have you found out anything more today, Modunya?" he asked me as I came in.
He had a half-written dispatch in front of him, and stuck his quill into the inkpot to wet it again. I pulled the damp hood off my hair with a crackle of static electricity, nodding. "There's a rumour that General Hawley is forming cavalry units in the south. He has orders for the formation of 8 regiments." Jamie grunted. Given the Highlanders' aversion to cavalry, this wasn't good news. Absent-mindedly, he rubbed his back, where the hoof-print-shaped bruise from Prestonpans had all but faded.
"I'll put it down for Colonel Cameron, then," he said. "How good a rumour do you think it is, Sassenach?"
Almost automatically he glanced over his shoulder to be sure we were alone. He called me Sassenach now, only in privacy, using the formality of Claire in public. "You can take it to the bank," I said. "I mean, it's good." It wasn't a rumour at all. It was the latest bit of intelligence from Jack Randall, the latest instalment payment on the debt he insisted on assuming for my care of his brother. Jamie knew, of course, that I visited Alex Randall, as well as the sick of the Jacobite army. What he didn't know, and what I could never tell him, was that once a week, sometimes more often, I would meet Jack Randall to hear what news seeped into Edinburgh Castle from the south. Sometimes he came to Alex's room when I was there. Other times I would be coming home in the winter twilight, watching my footing on the slippery cobbles of the Royal Mile, when suddenly a stick-straight form in brown homespun would beckon from the mouth of a close, or a quiet voice come out of the mist behind my shoulder. It was unnerving, like being haunted by Frank's ghost. It would have been simpler in many ways for him to leave a letter for me at Alex's lodging, but he would have nothing put in writing, and I could see his point. If such a letter was ever found, even unsigned, it could implicate not only him, but Alex as well. As it was, Edinburgh teemed with strangers, volunteers to King James's standard, curious visitors from south and north, foreign envoys from France and Spain, spies and informers in plenty. The only people not abroad on the streets were the officers and men of the English garrison, who remained mewed up in the castle. So long as no one heard him speak to me, no one would recognise him for what he was, nor think anything odd of our encounters, even were we seen, and we seldom were. Such were his precautions. For my own part, I was just as pleased. I would have had to destroy anything put in writing. While I doubted that Jamie would recognise Randall's hand, I couldn't explain a regular source of information without outright lying. Far better to make it appear that the information he gave me was merely part of the gleanings of my daily rounds. The drawback, of course, was that by treating Randall's contributions in the same light as the other rumours I collected, they might be discounted or ignored. Still, while I believed that Jack Randall was supplying information in good faith, assuming one could entertain such a concept in conjunction with the man, it didn't necessarily follow that it was always correct. As well to have it regarded sceptically. I relayed the news of Hawley's new regiments with the usual faint twinge of guilt at my quasi-deception. However, I had concluded that while honesty between husband and wife was essential, there was such a thing as carrying it too bloody far, and I saw no reason why the supplying of useful information to the Jacobites should cause Jamie further pain. "The Duke of Cumberland is still waiting for his troops to return from Flanders," I added, "and the siege of Stirling Castle is getting nowhere." Jamie grunted, scribbling busily.
"That much I knew. Lord George had a dispatch from Francis Townsend 2 days ago. He holds the town, but the ditches His Highness insisted on are wasting men and time. There's no need for them. They'd do better just to batter the castle from a distance with cannon fire, and then storm it."
"So why are they digging ditches?" Jamie waved a hand distractedly, still concentrating on his writing. His ears were pink with frustration.
"Because the Italian army dug ditches when they took Varano Castle, which is the only siege His Highness has seen. So, plainly, that's how it must be done, eh?"
"Och, aye," I said. It worked. He looked up at me and laughed, his eyes slanting half-shut with it.
"That's a very fair try, Sassenach," he said. "What else can you see?"
"Settle for the Lord's Prayer in Gaelic, would you?" I asked.
"No,"
he said, scattering sand across his dispatch. He got up, kissed me briefly, and reached for his coat.
"But I'll settle for some supper. Come along, Sassenach. We'll find a nice cosy tavern, and I'll teach you a lot of things you mustn't say in public. They're all fresh in my mind."
Stirling Castle fell at last. The cost had been high, the likelihood of holding it low, and the benefit in keeping it dubious. Still, the effect on Charles was euphoric and disastrous.
"I have succeeded at last in convincing Murray, such a stubborn fool as he is,"
Charles interjected, frowning. Then he remembered his victory and beamed around the room once more.
"I have prevailed, I say, though. We march into England on this day a week to reclaim all of my father's lands."
The Scottish chieftains gathered in the morning drawing-room glanced at each other, and there was considerable coughing and shifting of weight. The overall mood didn't seem to be one of wild enthusiasm at the news.
"Your Highness," Lord Kilmarnock began carefully, "would it not be wiser to consider—"
They tried. They all tried. Scotland, they pointed out, already belonged to Charles lock, stock and barrel. Men were still pouring in from the north, while from the south there seemed little promise of support. And the Scottish lords were all too aware that the Highlanders, while fierce fighters and loyal followers, were also farmers. Fields needed to be tilled for the spring planting. Cattle needed to be provisioned for overwintering. Many of the men would resist going deeply into the south in the winter months.
And these men? They are not my subjects. They go not where I command them. Nonsense,
Charles said firmly. And that was that. Almost.
James, my friend, wait. I speak with you a moment in private, if you please.
His Highness turned from a few sharp words with Lord Pitsligo, his long stubborn chin softening a bit as he waved a hand at Jamie. I didn't think I was included in this invitation. I hadn't any intention of leaving, though, and settled more firmly into one of the gold damask chairs as the Jacobite lords and chieftains filed out, muttering to each other.
Ha! Charles snapped his fingers contemptuously in the direction of the closing door. Old women, all of them. They will see. So will my cousin Louis. So will Philip. Do I need their help? I show them all.
I saw the pale manicured fingers touch briefly at a spot just over his breast. A faint rectangular outline showed through the silk of his coat. He was carrying Louise's miniature. I had seen it.
I wish your Highness every good fortune in the endeavour, Jamie murmured. But, ah, I thank you, cher James. You at least believe in me.
Charles threw an arm about Jamie's shoulders, massaging his deltoids affectionately.
I am desolated that you will not accompany me, that you will not be at my side to receive the applause of my subjects as we march into England,
Charles said, squeezing vigorously.
I won't. Jamie looked stunned. Alas, mon cher ami, duty demands of you a great sacrifice. I know how much your great heart yearns for the glories of battle, but I require you for another task.
You do? Said Jamie.
What? I said bluntly.
Charles cast a glance of well-mannered dislike in my direction, then turned back to Jamie and resumed the bonhomie.
It is a task of the greatest import, my James, and one that only you can do. It is true that men flock to my father's standard. More come every day. Still, we must not haste to feel secure, no? By such luck, your kinsmen, the Mackenzies, have come to my aid. But you have to your family another side, eh?
No, Jamie said, a look of horror dawning on his face.
But yes, said Charles, with a final squeeze.
He swung around to face Jamie, beaming.
You will go to the north, to the land of your fathers, and return to me at the head of the men of Clan Fraser.
Chapter 40 The Fox's Lair. Do you know your grandfather well? I asked, waving away an unseasonable deer fly that seemed unable to make up its mind whether I or the horse would make a better meal. Jamie shook his head.
No, I've heard he acts like a terrible old monster, but you shouldn't be scared of him.
He smiled at me as I swatted the deer fly with the end of my shawl.
I'll be with you.
Oh, crusty old gentleman, don't bother me, I assured him. I've seen a good many of those in my time. Soft as butter underneath, the most of them. I imagine your grandfather's much the same.
No, he replied thoughtfully. He really is a terrible old monster. It's only if you act scared of him, it makes him worse. Like a beast scenting blood, you can.
I cast a look ahead, where the far-off hills that hid Beaufort Castle suddenly loomed in a rather sinister manner. Taking advantage of my momentary lack of attention, the deerfly made a strafing run past my left ear. I squeaked and ducked to the side, and the horse, taken aback by this sudden movement, shied in a startled manner.
"Hey! Kustad!"
Jamie dove sideways to grab my reins, dropping his own. Better schooled than my own mount, his horse snorted, but accommodated this manoeuvre, merely flicking its ear in a complacently superior way. Jamie dug his knees into his horse's sides, pulling mine to a stop alongside.
"Now then," he said, narrowed eyes following the zigzag flight of the humming deerfly. "Let him light, Sassenach, and I'll get him."
He waited, hands raised at the ready, squinting slightly in the sunlight. I sat like a mildly nervous statue, half-hypnotized by the menacing buzz. The heavy-winged body, deceptively slow, hummed lazily back and forth between the horse's ears and my own. The horse's ears twitched violently, an impulse with which I was in complete sympathy. "If that thing lands in my ear, Jamie, I'm going to—" I began. "Shh!" he ordered, leaning forward in anticipation, left hand cupped like a panther about to strike. "Another second and I'll have him." Just then I saw the dark blob alight on his shoulder. Another deer fly seeking a basking place. I opened my mouth again. "Jamie!"
"Hush!"
He clapped his hand together triumphantly on my tormentor, a split second before the deer fly on his collar sank its fangs into his neck. Scottish clansmen fought according to their ancient traditions. Disdaining strategy, tactics, and subtlety, their method of attack was simplicity itself. Spotting the enemy within range, they dropped their blades, drew their swords, and charged the foe, shrieking at the tops of their lungs. Gaelic shrieking being what it is, this method was more often successful than not. A good many enemies, seeing a mass of hairy, bare-limbed banshees bearing down on them, simply lost all nerve and fled. Well-schooled as it might ordinarily be, nothing had prepared Jamie's horse for a grade A number one Gaelic shriek, uttered at top volume from a spot 2 feet behind its head. Losing all nerve, it laid back its ears and fled as though the devil itself were after it. My mount and I sat transfixed in the road, watching an outstanding exhibition of Scottish horsemanship, as Jamie, both stirrups lost and the reins free, flung half out of his saddle by his horse's abrupt departure, heaved himself desperately forward, grappling for the mane. His plaid fluttered madly about him, stirred by the wind of his passing, and the horse, thoroughly panicked by this time, took the thrashing mass of colour as an excuse to run even faster. One hand tangled in the long mane, Jamie was grimly hauling himself upright, long legs clasping the horse's sides, ignoring the stirrup irons that danced beneath the beast's belly. Scraps of what even my limited Gaelic recognised as extremely bad language floated back on the gentle wind. A slow, clopping sound made me look behind, to where Murtaugh, leading the pack horse, was coming over the small rise we had just descended. He made his careful way down the road to where I waited. He pulled his animal to a leisurely stop, shaded his eyes, and looked ahead, to the spot where Jamie and his panicked mount were just vanishing over the next hilltop. "A deer fly," I said in explanation.
"Late for them. Still, I didna think he'd be in such a hurry to meet his grandsire as to leave you behind," Murtaugh remarked with his customary dryness. "Not that I'd see a wife, more or less, will make much difference in his reception."
He picked up his reins and booted his pony into reluctant motion, the pack horse amiably coming along for the journey. My own mount, cheered by the company and reassured by a temporary absence of flies, stepped out quite gaily alongside. "Not even an English wife?" I asked curiously. From the little I knew, I didn't think Lord Lovat's relations with anything English were much to cheer about.
"English, French, Dutch or German, it isna like to make much difference. It'll be the lad's liver the old fox will be eating for breakfast, not yours."
"What do you mean by that?" I stared at the dour little clansman, looking much like one of his own bundles, under the loose wrapping of plaid and shirt. Somehow, every garment that Murtaugh put on, no matter how new or how well tailored, immediately assumed the appearance of something narrowly salvaged from a rubbish heap. "What kind of terms is Jamie on with Lord Lovat?" I caught a sidelong glance from a small, shrewd black eye, and then his head turned towards Beaufort Castle. He shrugged, in resignation or anticipation.
"No terms at all, till now. The lad's never spoken to his grandsire in his life."
"But how do you know so much about him if you've never met him?" At least I was beginning to understand Jamie's earlier reluctance to approach his grandfather for help. reunited with Jamie and his horse, the latter looking rather chastened, and the former irritable to a degree, Murtaugh had gazed speculatively at him and offered to ride ahead to Beaufort with the pack animal, leaving Jamie and me to enjoy lunch at the side of the road. Over a restorative ale and oatcake, he had at length told me that his grandfather, Lord Lovett, hadn't approved of his son's choice of bride, and hadn't seen fit either to bless the union or to communicate with his son or his son's children any time since the marriage of Brian Fraser and Ellen Mackenzie more than 30 years before.
"I've heard a good bit about him, one way and another, though,"
Jamie replied, chewing a bite of cheese.
"He's the sort of a man that makes an impression on folk, you ken."
"So I gather." The elderly Tullibardine, one of the Parisian Jacobites, had regaled me with a number of uncensored opinions regarding the leader of Clan Fraser, and I thought that perhaps Brian Fraser had not been desolated at his father's inattention. I said as much, and Jamie nodded.
"Oh, I cannot recall my father having much good to say of the old man, though he wouldna be disrespectful of him. He just didna speak of him often."
He rubbed at the side of his neck, where a red welt from the deer-fly bite was beginning to show. The weather was freakishly warm, and he had unfolded his plaid for me to sit on. The deputation to the head of Clan Fraser had been thought worth some investment in dignity, and Jamie wore a new kilt of the buckled military cut, with the plaid a separate strip of cloth. Less enveloping for shelter from the weather than the older belted plaid, it was a good deal more efficient to put on in a hurry.
"I wondered a bit," he said thoughtfully, "whether my father was the sort of father he was because of the way old Simon treated him. I didn't realise it at the time, of course, but it's no so common for a man to show his feelings for his sons."
"You've thought about it a lot." I offered him another flask of ale, and he took it with a smile that lingered on me, more warming than the feeble autumn sun.
"Aye, I did. I was wondering, you see, what sort of father I'd be to my own bairns, and looking back a bit to see my own father being the best example I had. Yet I knew from the bits that he'd said, or that Murtaugh told me, that his own father was nothing like him. So I thought as how he must have made up his mind to do it all differently, once he had the chance."
I sighed a bit, setting down my bit of cheese. "Jamie," I said, "do you really think we'll ever—"
"I do,"
he said with certainty, not letting me finish. He leaned over and kissed my forehead.
"I know it, Sassenach, and so do you. You were meant to be a mother, and I surely didn't intend to let anyone else father your children."
"Well, that's good," I said. "Neither do I." He laughed and tilted my chin up to kiss my lips. I kissed him back, then reached up to brush away a breadcrumb that clung to the stubble around his mouth. "Ought you to shave, do you think?" I asked, "in honour of seeing your grandfather for the first time."
"Oh, I've seen him the once before," he said casually, "and he's seen me for that matter. As for what he thinks of my looks now, he can take me as I am, and be damned to him."
"But Murtaugh said you'd never met him."
"Mm-hmm."
He brushed the rest of the crumbs from his shirt front, frowning slightly, as if deciding how much to tell me. Finally, he shrugged and lay back in the shade of a gorse bush, hands clasped behind his head as he stared at the sky.
"Well, we've never have met, as you'd say. Or not exactly. 'Twas like this."
At the age of 17, young Jamie Fraser set sail for France to finish his education at the University of Paris, and to learn further such things are as not taught in books.
"I sailed from the harbour at Beaulieu," he said, nodding over the next hill, where a narrow slice of grey on the far horizon marked the edge of the Moray Firth. "There were other ports I could have gone by. Inverness would have been most like. But my father booked my passage, and from Beaulieu it was. He rode with me, to see me off into the world, you might see."
Brian Fraser had seldom left Lallybroch in the years since his marriage, and took pleasure, as they rode, in pointing out various spots to his son, where he had hunted or travelled as boy and young man.
but he grew much quieter as we drew near Beaufort. He hadn't spoken of my grandsire on this trip, and I knew better than mention him myself. But I kent he had reason for sending me from Bewley.
A number of small sparrows edged their way cautiously nearer, popping in and out of the low shrubs, ready to dart back to safety at the slightest hint of danger. Seeing them, Jamie reached for a remnant of bread and tossed it with considerable accuracy into the middle of the flock, which exploded like shrapnel, all fleeing the sudden intrusion.
"They'll be back," he said, motioning toward the scattered birds.
He put an arm across his face as though to shield it from the sun, and went on with his story.
There was a sound of horses along the road from the castle, and when we turned to see, there was a small party coming down, six horsemen with a wagon, and one of them held Lovett's banner, so I knew my grandfather was with them. I looked quick at my father to see did he mean to do anything, but he just smiled and squeezed my shoulder quick and said, "Let's go aboard then, lad." I could feel my grandsire's eyes on me as I walked down the shore with my hair and my height fair shrieking, "Mackenzie!" And I was glad I had my best clothes on and didna look a beggar. I didna look round, but I stood as tall as I could, and was proud that I had half a head's height above the tallest man there. My father walked by my side, quiet like he was, and he didna look aside either, but I could feel him there, proud that he'd sired me.
He smiled at me, lopsided.
"That was the last time I was sure I'd done well by him, Sassenach. I wasna so sure times after, but I was glad of that one day."
He locked his arms around his knees, staring ahead as though reliving the scene on the quay.
"We stepped aboard the ship and met the master. Then we stood by the rail, talking a bit about nothing, both of us careful not to look at the men from Beaufort who were loading the bundles, or glance to the shore where the horsemen stood. Then the master gave the order to cast off. I kissed my father, then he jumped over the rail, down to the dock, and walked to his horse. He didna look back until he was mounted, and by then the ship had started out into the harbour. I waved, and he waved back, then he turned, leading my horse, and started on the road back to Lallybroch. And the party from Beaufort turned then too and started back. I could see my grandsire at the head of the party, sitting straight in his saddle. And they rode, my father and grandfather, 20 yards apart, up the hill and over it, out of my sight. And neither one turned to the other, or acted as though the other one was there at all.
He turned his head down the road, as though looking for signs of life from the direction of Beaufort.
"I met his eyes," he said softly, "the once. I waited until father reached his horse, and then I turned and looked at Lord Lovett, bold as I could. I wanted him to know we'd asked nothing of him, but that I wasna scared of him."
He smiled at me, one-sided.
"I was, though."
I put a hand over his, stroking the grooves of his knuckles.
"Was he looking back at you?"
He snorted briefly.
"Aye, he was. Reckon he didn't take his eyes off me from the time I came down the hill till my ship sailed away. I could feel them boring into my back like an auger. And when I looked at him, there he was, wi' his eyes black under his brows, staring into mine."
He fell silent, still looking at the castle, till I gently prodded him. "How did he look then?" He pulled his eyes from the dark cloud mass on the far horizon to look down at me, the customary expression of good humour missing from the curve of his mouth, the depths of his eyes.
"Cold as stone, Sassenach," he replied. "Cold as the stone."
We were lucky in the weather. It had been warm all the way from Edinburgh.
"It's no going to last,"
Jamie predicted, squinting toward the sea ahead.
"See the bank of cloud out there? It'll be inland by tonight."
He sniffed the air and pulled his plaid across his shoulders.
"Smell the air. You can feel weather coming."
Not so experienced at olfactory meteorology, I still thought that perhaps I could smell it. A dampness in the air, sharpening the usual smells of dried heather and pine resin, with a faint, moist scent of kelp from the distant shore mixed in. "I wonder if the men have got back to Lallybroch yet," I said.
"I doubt it."
Jamie shook his head.
"They've less distance to go than we've had, but they're all afoot, and it will have been slow getting them all away."
He rose in his stirrups, shading his eyes to peer toward the distant cloud bank.
"I hope it's just rain. That will not trouble them over much. And it might not be a big storm in any case. Perhaps it will not reach so far south."
I pulled my arisad, a warm tartan shawl, tighter around my own shoulders in response to the rising breeze. I had thought this few days' stretch of warm weather a good omen. I hoped it hadn't been deceptive. Jamie had spent an entire night sitting by the window in Holyrood after receipt of Charles's order. And in the morning he had gone first to Charles to tell His Highness that he and I would ride alone to Bewley, accompanied only by Murtagh, to convey His Highness's respects to Lord Lovett, and his request that Lovett honour his promise of men and aid. Next, Jamie had summoned Ross the smith to our chamber, and given him his orders in a voice so low that I couldn't make out the words from my place near the fire. I had seen the burly smith's shoulders rise, though, and set firm as he absorbed their import. The Highland army travelled with little discipline, in a ragtag mob that could scarcely be dignified as a column. In the course of one day's movement, the men of Lallybroch were to drop away, one by one, stepping aside into the shrubbery as though to rest a moment or relieve themselves. They were not to return to the main body, but to steal quietly away and make their way, one by one, to a rendezvous with the other men from Lallybroch. And once regathered under the command of Ross the smith, they were to go home.
"I doubt they'll be missed for some time, if at all," Jamie had said, discussing the plan with me beforehand. "Desertion is rife all through the army. Ewan Cameron told me they'd lost 20 men from his regiment within the last week. It's winter, and the men want to be settling their homes and making things ready for the spring planting. In any case, it's sure there's no one to spare to go after them, even should their leaving be noticed."
"Have you given up then, Jamie?" I had asked, laying a hand on his arm. He had rubbed a hand tiredly over his face before answering.
"I dinna ken, Sassenach. It may be too late, it may not. I canna tell. It was foolish to go south so near to the winter, and more foolish still to waste time in besieging Stirling. But Charles hasna been defeated, and the chiefs, some of them, are coming in answer to his summons. The Mackenzies, now, and others because of them. He's twice as many men now as we had at Preston. What will that mean?"
He flung up his hands, frustrated.
"I dinna ken. There's no opposition. The English are terrified. Well, you know, you've seen the broadsheets."
He smiled without humour.
"We spit small children and roast them over the fire and dishonour the wives and daughters of honest men."
He gave a snort of wry disgust. While such crimes as theft and insubordination were common among the Highland army, rape was virtually unknown. He sighed, a brief angry sound.
"Cameron's heard a rumour that King Geordie's making ready to flee from London in fear that the Prince's army will take the city soon."
He had, a rumour that had reached Cameron through me from Jack Randall.
"And there's Kilmarnock and Cameron, the Heel and Balmerino and Dougal with his Mackenzies. Bonny fighters all. And should Lovett send the men he's promised, God, maybe it would be enough. Christ, should we march into London?"
He hunched his shoulders, then stretched suddenly, shrugging, as though to fight his way out of a strangling shirt.
"But I canna risk it," he said simply. "I canna go to Bewley and leave my own men here to be taken God knows where. If I were there to head them, that would be something else. But damned if I'll leave them for Charles or Dougal to throw at the English, and me 100 miles away at Bewley.
So it was arranged. The Lallybroch men, including Fergus, who had protested vociferously but been overruled, would desert and depart inconspicuously for home. Once our business at Bewley was completed and we had returned to join Charles, well, then it would be time enough to see how matters went.
"That's why I'm taking Myrto with us," Jamie had explained. "If it looks all right, then I shall send him to Lallybroch to fetch them back."
A brief smile lightened his sombre face.
"It doesn't look much on a horse, but he's a braw rider, is Myrto. Fast as chain lightning." He didn't look it at the moment, I reflected. But then there was no emergency at hand.
In fact, he was moving even slower than usual. As we topped one hill, I could see him at the bottom pulling his horse to a halt. By the time we had reached him, he was off, glaring at the pack horse's saddle.
"What's amiss, then?"
Jamie made to get down from his own saddle, but Myrto waved him irritably off.
"Nay, nay, not to trouble ye. A binding snapped is all. Get ye on."
With no more than a nod of acknowledgement, Jamie reined away, and I followed him.
"Not very canty today, is he?"
I remarked, with a flip of the hand back in Myrtle's direction. In fact, the small clansman had grown more testy and irritable with each step in the direction of Bewley. "I take it he's not enchanted with the prospect of visiting Lord Lovett?" Jamie smiled, with a brief backward glance at the small, dark figure bent in absorption over the rope he was splicing.
"Nay, Myrtle's no friend of old Simon. He loved my father dearly."
His mouth quirked to one side.
"And my mother as well. He didn't care for Lovett's treatment of them, or for Lovett's methods of getting wives. Myrtle's got an Irish grandmother, but he's related to Primrose Campbell through his mother's side," he explained,
as though this made everything crystal clear.
"Who's Primrose Campbell?"
I asked, bewildered.
"Oh."
Jamie scratched his nose, considering. The wind off the sea was rising steadily, and his hair was being whipped from its lacing, ruddy wisps flickering past his face.
"Primrose Campbell was Lovett's third wife. Still is, I suppose," he added, "though she's left him some years since and gone back to her father's house."
"Popular with women, is he?"
I murmured. Jamie snorted.
"I suppose you can call it that. He took his first wife by a forced marriage, snatched the dowager Lady Lovett from her bed in the middle of the night, married her then and there, and went straight back to bed with her. Still," he added fairly, "she did later decide she loved him, so maybe he wasn't so bad."
"Must have been rather special in bed, at least," I said flippantly.
"Runs in the family, I expect."
He cast me a mildly shocked look, which dissolved into a sheepish grin.
"Aye, well," he said. "If he was or no, it didn't help him much. The dowager's maid spoke up against him, and Simon was outlawed and had to flee to France."
"Forced marriages and outlawry, hm?"
I refrained from further remark on family resemblances, but privately trusted that Jamie wouldn't follow in his grandfather's footsteps with regard to subsequent wives. One had apparently been insufficient for Simon.
"He went to visit King James in Rome and swear his fealty to the Stuarts," Jamie went on, "and then turned round and went straight to William of Orange, King of England, who was visiting in France. He got James to promise him his title and estates should a restoration come about, and then, God knows how, got a full pardon from William and was able to come home to Scotland."
Now it was my turn for raised eyebrows. Apparently it wasn't just attractiveness to the opposite sex, then. Simon had continued his adventures by returning later to France, this time to spy on the Jacobites. Being found out, he was thrown into prison, but escaped, returned to Scotland, masterminded the assembling of the clans under the guise of a hunting party on the braes of Mar in 1715, and then managed to get full credit with the English crown for putting down the resultant rising. "Proper old twister, isn't he?" I said, completely intrigued. "Though I suppose he can't have been so old then, only in his 40s. Having heard that Lord Lovat was now in his middle 70s, I'd been expecting something fairly doddering and decrepit, but was rapidly revising my expectations in view of these stories.
"My grandsire," Jamie observed evenly, "has, by all reports, got a character that would enable him to hide conveniently behind a spiral staircase. Anyway," he went on, dismissing his grandfather's character with a wave of his hand, "then he married Margaret Grant, the Grant o' Grant's daughter. That was after she died that he married Primrose Campbell. She was maybe 18 at the time."
"Was old Simon enough of a catch for her family to force her into it?" I asked sympathetically.
"By no means, Sassenach."
He paused to brush the hair out of his face, tucking the stray locks back behind his ears.
"He kent well enough that she wouldn't have him, no matter if he was as rich as Croesus, which he wasn't. So he had her sent a letter, saying her mother was fallen sick in Edinburgh, and giving the house there she was to go to.
Hastening to Edinburgh, the young and beautiful Miss Campbell had found not her mother, but the old and ingenious Simon Fraser, who had informed her that she was in a notorious house of pleasure, and that her only hope of preserving her good name was to marry him immediately.
"She must have been a right gump to fall for that one," I remarked cynically.
"Well, she was very young," Jamie said defensively, "and it wasn't an idle threat either. Had she refused him, old Simon would have ruined her reputation without a second thought. In any event, she married him, and regretted it."
I was busy doing sums in my head. The encounter with Primrose Campbell had been only a few years ago, he'd said. Then, "Was it the Dowager Lady Lovat or Margaret Grant who was your grandmother?" I asked curiously. The high cheekbones were chapped by sun and wind. Now they flushed a sudden, painful red.
"Neither one," he said.
He didn't look at me, but kept his gaze fixed straight ahead in the direction of Beaufort Castle. His lips were pressed tightly together.
"My father was a bastard," he said at last.
He sat straight as a sword in the saddle, and his knuckles were white, fist clenched on the reins.
"Acknowledged, but a bastard. By one of the Castle Downy Meads."
"Oh," I said. There didn't seem a lot to add. He swallowed hard. I could see the ripple in his throat.
"I should have told you before," he said stiffly. "I'm sorry."
I reached out to touch his arm. It was hard as iron.
"It doesn't matter, Jamie," I said, knowing even as I spoke that nothing I said could make a difference. "I don't mind in the slightest."
"Aye,"
he said at last, still staring straight ahead.
"Well, I do."
The steadily freshening wind off the Moray Firth rustled its way through a hillside of dark pines. The country here was an odd combination of mountain slope and seashore. Thick growth of alders, larch, and birch blanketed the ground on both sides of the narrow track we followed. But as we approached the dark bulk of Beaufort Castle, over everything floated the effluvium of mudflats and kelp. We were, in fact, expected. The kilted, axe-armed sentries at the gate made no challenge as we rode through. They looked at us curiously enough, but seemingly without enmity. Jamie sat straight as a king in his saddle. He nodded once to the man on his side, and received a similar nod in return. I had the distinct feeling that we entered the castle flying a white flag of truce. How long that state would last was anyone's guess. We rode unchallenged into the courtyard of Beaufort Castle. A small edifice, as castles went, but sufficiently imposing, for all that, built of the native stone. Not so heavily fortified as some of the castles I had seen to the south, it looked still capable of withstanding a certain amount of abrasion. Wide-mouthed gun holes gaped at intervals along the base of the outer walls, and the keep still boasted a stable opening onto the courtyard. Several of the small Highland ponies were housed in this, heads poking over the wooden half-door to whicker in welcome to our own mounts. Near the wall lay a number of packs, recently unloaded from the ponies in the stable.
"Lovett summoned a few men to meet us,"
Jamie observed grimly, noting the packs.
"Relatives, I expect."
He shrugged.
"At least they'll be friendly enough to start with."
"How do you know?" He slid to the ground and reached up to help me down.
"They've left the broadswords with the luggage."
Jamie handed over the reins to an ostler who came out of the stables to meet us, dusting his hands on his breeks.
Now what?
I murmured to Jamie under my breath. There was no sign of chatelaine or major domo, nothing like the cheery, authoritative figure of Mrs. Fitzgibbons that had welcomed us to Castle Leoch 2 years before. The few ostlers and stable lads about glanced at us now and then, but continued about their tasks, as did the servants who crossed the courtyard, lugging baskets of laundry, bundles of peat, and all the other cumbrous paraphernalia that living in a stone castle demanded. I looked approvingly after a burly manservant sweating under the burden of 2 5-gallon copper cans of water. Whatever its shortcomings in the hospitality department, Beaufort Castle at least boasted a bathtub somewhere. Jamie stood in the centre of the courtyard, arms crossed, surveying the place like a prospective buyer of real estate who harbours black doubts about the drains.
"No, we wait, Sassenach," he said. "The sentries will have sent word that we're here. Either someone will come down to us, or they won't."
"Ah," I said. "Well, I hope they make up their minds about it soon. I'm hungry, and I could do with a wash."
"Aye, you could," Jamie agreed, with a brief smile as he looked me over. "You've a smut on your nose, and there's teasel heads caught in your hair. No, leave them," he added, as my hand went to my head in dismay. "It looks bonny. Did you do it on purpose or no?"
"Definitely no. But I left them." Still, I sidled over to a nearby watering trough to inspect my appearance and remedy it so far as was possible, using nothing but cold water. It was something of a delicate situation, so far as old Simon Fraser was concerned, I thought, bending over the trough, and trying to make out which blotches on my reflected complexion were actual smudges, and which caused by floating bits of hay. On the one hand, Jamie was a formal emissary from the Stuarts. Whether Lovett's promises of support for the cause were honest, or mere lip service, chances were that he would feel obliged to welcome the prince's representative, if only for the sake of courtesy. On the other hand, said representative was an illegitimately descended grandson who, if not precisely disowned in his own person, certainly wasn't a bosom member of the family either. And I knew enough by now of Highland feuds to know that ill-feeling of this sort was unlikely to be diminished by the passage of time. I ran a wet hand across my closed eyes and back across my temples, smoothing down stray wisps of hair. On the whole, I didn't think Lord Lovett would leave us standing in the courtyard. He might, however, leave us there long enough to realise fully the dubious nature of our reception. After that, well, who knew? We would most likely be received by Lady Frances, one of Jamie's aunts, a widow who, from all we had heard from Tullibardine, managed domestic affairs for her father. Or, if he chose to receive us as a diplomatic ambassade rather than as family connections, I suppose that Lord Lovett himself might appear to receive us, supported by the formal panoply of secretary, guards, and servants. This last possibility seemed most likely, in view of the time it was taking. After all, you wouldn't keep a full-dress entourage standing about. It would take some time to assemble the necessary personnel. Envisioning the sudden appearance of a fully equipped Earl, I had second thoughts about leaving teasel heads tangled in my hair, and leaned over the trough again. At this point, I was interrupted by the sound of footsteps in the passageway behind the mangers. A squat-bodied elderly man, in open shirt and unbuckled breeks, stepped out into the courtyard, shoving aside a plump chestnut mare with a sharp elbow and an irritable Despite his age, he had a back like a ramrod, and shoulders nearly as broad as Jamie's. Pausing by the horse trough, he glanced around the courtyard as though looking for someone. His eye passed over me without registering, then suddenly snapped back, clearly startled. He stepped forward and thrust his face pugnaciously forward, an unshaven grey beard bristling like a porcupine's quills.
"Who the hell are you?" he demanded.
"Claire Fraser. Lady Brock Turoch," I said, belatedly remembering my dignity. I gathered my self-possession and wiped a drop of water off my chin. "Who the hell are you?" I demanded. A firm hand gripped my elbow from behind, and a resigned voice from somewhere above my head said,
"That Sassnach is my grandsire. My lord, may I present my wife?" "Ah," said Lord Lovett, giving me the benefit of a cold blue eye. "I'd heard you'd married an English woman."
His tone made it clear that this act confirmed all his worst suspicions about the grandson he'd never met. He raised a thick grey brow in my direction and shifted the gimlet stare to Jamie.
"No more sense than your father, it seems."
I could see Jamie's hands twitch slightly, resisting the urge to clench into fists.
"At the least, I'd nae need to take a wife by reap or trickery," he observed evenly.
His grandfather grunted, unfazed by the insult. I thought I saw the corner of his wrinkled mouth twitch, but wasn't sure.
"Aye, and you've gained little enough by the bargain you struck," he observed. "Though at that, this one's less expensive than that Mackenzie harlot Brian fell prey to. If this Sassenach wench brings ye naught, at least she looks as though she costs ye little."
The slanted blue eyes, so much like Jamie's own, ran over my travel-stained gown, taking in the unstitched hem, the burst seam, and the splashes of mud on the skirt. I could feel a fine vibration run through Jamie, and wasn't sure whether it was anger or laughter. "Thanks," I said, with a friendly smile at his lordship. "I don't eat much either, but I could use a bit of a wash. Just water. Don't bother about the soap if it comes too dear." This time, I was sure about the twitch.
"Aye, I see," his lordship said. "I shall send a maid to see ye to your rooms, then, and provide ye with soup. We shall see you in the library before supper, grandson," he added to Jamie,
and turning on his heel, disappeared back under the archway. "Who's we?" I asked.
"Young Simon, I suppose," Jamie answered. "His lordship's heir. A stray cousin or two, maybe. And some of the taxmen, I should imagine, judging from the horses in the courtyard. If Lovett's going to consider sending troops to join the Stuarts, his taxmen and tenants may have a bit to say about it." "Ever seen a small worm in a barnyard in the middle of a flock of chickens?" he murmured, as we walked down the hall an hour later behind a servant. "That's me. Or us, I should say. Stick close to me now."
The various connections of Clan Fraser were indeed assembled. When we were shown into the Beaufort Castle library, it was to find more than 20 men seated around the room. Jamie was formally introduced, and gave a formal statement on behalf of the Stuarts, giving the respects of Prince Charles and King James to Lord Lovett, and appealing for Lovett's help, to which the old man replied briefly, eloquently, and non-committally. Etiquette attended to, I was then brought forward,